In a world in which movies struggle to find plot, Alan Adams of The Main Edge breaks it down for you in Pass the Popcorn. Now on Downtown with Rich Kimball.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby.
Oh my goodness, yes. Let's all go. Time for us to talk movies and more. As Alan Adams joins us right here in studio. Hello, Al.
Hello, sir. How are you?
Well, yeah, I'm fine. I'm okay. I'm still adjusting to the fact that we only see you once a week now.
I know. It's not nearly as much fun. But it makes our time together all the more special.
Well, that's true. That's true. Absolutely. Before we talk about movies, how did the weekend go for you and Stella and the Kibbles and Picks?
It's funny. After all is said and done, we have one game yet to be determined. But as of right now, it's 3-3 again. So
wow.
I'm keeping things close.
Wow.
Which makes me very happy. But I've got the Vikings tonight over the Eagles. I feel pretty good about that. Mm-hmm. This Vikings team looks really talented. But then on the other hand, it's like, well, Jalen Hurts is the quarterback of my fantasy football team, and I sure could use a good game out of him. Mm. Although the reality is there's no game good enough that's going to salvage my week because our good friend Jason Preble has a small but significant shot at putting up the highest single season scoring in the history of our fantasy football league.
Wow.
Yeah, like he's sitting at 177, and he's got Stephon Diggs going tonight. And so it's just like, it would have to be a massive game, but it's within the realm of possibility because that's Stephon Diggs. He's pretty good at football.
So Jason hasn't forsaken all fantasy sports, just our baseball league.
Yeah, well, I mean, the reality is fantasy football is considerably easier.
Right.
I think just in terms of time commitment and, you're only dealing with, I was going to say 60, it's 17 games now as opposed to 162. Mm. And, the rosters are considerably smaller and et cetera. So I get it. I mean, he's a coward, but I get it. And it will never not be funny to me that the team he walked away from is running away with the championship this year.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
I mean, don't get me wrong. Aaron Jackson has done a wonderful job managing that team. And he's made plenty of choices that have benefited the team, he himself. But got to admit, the foundation... We'll just say that Mr. Jackson had a much stronger foundation under him than, say, I had when I arrived.
Right. whose team did you inherit?
I believe it was the Rev.
Yeah, Jim Churchill's team. Yeah. Well, there you go. Explain. We probably had a lot of Red Sox guys in single A.
Man, and it's like it's so funny because that was a long time ago.
Oh, it was.
It's one of those things. It's like I've been in the league for like 10 years now, and I'm still one of the baby faces.
Well, so we got some geezers.
You sure do.
There are even people older than me.
I know.
And that's just crazy. I want to talk, too, before we get to the movies, just briefly, you had a chance to see the new show at Penobscot Theater Company.
Yeah, I went to see opening night of Clarkston, the Samuel Hunter play that marks the debut show, both as artistic director and as director for Jonathan Barry, who is the new guy in charge over there. It's a phenomenal play, man. Like I didn't I came in clean. Like I made a conscious effort not to know too much about what was going on. It's a beautifully written play, one that has themes that I think will resonate very strongly with people in this area in terms of I'm not going to talk too much about it because I don't want to spoil anything for anybody. I think it's the less you know, the better off you are. But I will say the two gentlemen who are playing the leads are both give phenomenal performances, and our good friend Jenny Hart absolutely crushes it in a supporting role in this show. Like she's just she's very very talented and one of these people who can do it all. Comedy, drama, etc., and she really sort of flexes those muscles in the show. So yeah, Clarkston, you got two more weekends to see it, and I can't recommend it highly enough. Just a phenomenal night at the theater.
Excellent, I appreciate that. Let's talk about movies. You've got a couple to share your opinions on this week.
I do, and a couple of really good ones actually. Like I enjoyed both of these movies very much. So what do you want to What do you want to start with? Do you want to start with the comedic deconstruction of the Agatha Christie, or do you want to start with the high school girl prep school version of Strangers on a Train? Which one do you want?
Let's go Agatha Christie.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. So I saw this movie. It's called See How They Run, and it is for a certain crowd. A crowd that I think includes us pretty firmly. This is a delightful film because it is a movie that both clearly loves and has great fun skewering the sort of the murder mystery cottage industry that has sprung up around the works of Agatha Christie. It's a murder mystery that happens on the fringes of a play that is a murder mystery. And so you've got this wonderfully layered sort of meta take on it. And it's got, it's wonderfully written. It's got some phenomenal performances, and man, there are so many inside baseball jokes, in this show. Like, anyone who has spent time in the theater is going to get chuckles, that will confuse anyone, who has not spent a lot of time, in the theater. That's not to say that people who aren't theater people won't enjoy this, because I think it's just generally a good movie. But man, some of these references, man, some winks and nods that are really a lot of fun. So the basic gist is we're in it's the 1950s. We're in London's West End. And Agatha Christie's The Mousetrap is a sensation. It's just recently started its run. They're in the process of celebrating its 100th performance, which is hilarious to anyone who knows that The Mousetrap has basically been running in the West End forever. Like, The Mousetrap has been in the West End almost as long as Queen Elizabeth was queen. It's one of those things where it's just been a constant part of the theatrical scene over there. But this is at the beginning, so it's got, you know, you've got this show starring Dickie Attenborough, which is hilarious. So you've got this show, and the whole gist is we have a film producer who wants to make a film version of The Mousetrap, but part of the contractual language is that you can't make a movie of The Mousetrap until it closes. And so that's, I guess it's, you know, there's a whole bit about how it's standard, you know, standard language and Agatha Christie contracts and et cetera, et cetera. And so the producer of the show is in conflict with the producer of the erstwhile producer of the movie. Meanwhile, they've imported a brash American to potentially direct the film version. A guy by the name of Leo Kopernik, played by Adrian Brody, who also serves as our narrator of sorts, the person who sort of, gives us our framing device. But so they're doing the show. It's wonderful. They have the 100th performance. There's a celebration. A fight breaks out at the party between our man Leo and Dickie Attenborough. And so there's some complications there. Leo heads off. He's a little drunk. Heads off in search of a change of clothes because he gets tackled through a cake. That's kind of a spoiler, but it's fine. We're going through all this this stuff, and before you know it, all these conflicts, they boil over, and somebody is murdered.
Mm.
I'm not going to tell you who. Mm. Not least because they make a callback several times to the famous bit in The Mousetrap where they basically break the fourth wall, address the audience, and be like, "Don't tell anyone who did it." We get that a couple of times. Like, we are addressed directly as the audience of the film in similar circumstances. So there's a murder, needs to be solved. In comes world-weary alcoholic Inspector Stoppard, played by Sam Rockwell. Partnered with the wide-eyed and naive newcomer to the force, Constable Stalker, played by Saoirse Ronan. And the two of them must team up, this odd couple, in an effort to solve the mysterious murder Or is it murders?
Yes.
And that's all I'm telling you. That's all I'm going to tell you, Rich, because one of the joys of the sort of Christie oeuvre is the fact that it's so much more fun when you don't know. And you can sort of follow along and try to figure out, well, who done it, as they say. I had such a great time watching this movie. The performances are phenomenal, obviously. Sam Rockwell's great. Saoirse Ronan is great. The two of them together work really well. A phenomenal supporting cast, just up and down the entire cast list. Some familiar faces. I mentioned Adrian Brody. David Oyelowo is in this movie. But also some folks who are maybe more familiar to fans of British television or the British stage. Like these are actors who are famous in their own right, but not necessarily famous to American audiences. So it's this wonderful sort of a juxtaposition there, which is really nice. And again, I talked about the meta nature of the fact that we have a murder mystery, on the fringes of a murder mystery, which is really fun. But it goes so much harder than that in terms of the theatrical references. Among the hardest times I've laughed in a movie theater in a long time. And this is a joke that like maybe five of your listeners are going to get. but there's a line, and it's just a throwaway line. It's someone in the police commissioner's office at Scotland Yard talking to Sam Rockwell's character, Inspector Stoppard. And the line is, yes, he was a real hound, Inspector Stoppard.
But when you mentioned Stoppard, I thought, oh, I love it.
For those who are unfamiliar, the real Inspector Hound is a play written by the eminent British playwright, Tom Stoppard. A titular role, I might add, I myself have played on stage many a year ago. And so, like, that came out, and I'm like, okay, this movie clearly gets me. And there's just a bunch of stuff like that. Sort of hints and feints towards the sort of theatrical realities of the mid-20th century and the sort of overlap between the stage and the screen that was kind of happening at that point. And the truth is, I think it's really difficult to make a good movie about the theater. Like, there have been, obviously there have been many plays adapted to the screen, but that's not what I'm talking about. Like, I'm talking about a movie that is about the theater. And I don't know why exactly it's proven so difficult. Like, I mean, there are some wonderful examples out there, but for whatever reason, the majority of these types of things sort of tend to fall a little bit flat. That is not the case here. It is fun. It is vibrant. We get a wonderful sense of the sort of madcap mayhem that was the London theater scene in the mid-1950s. You have your uptight Brits and your brash Americans and all this stuff in between. Just an absolutely delightful time at the movies. Again, if you are a theater person, it's going to hit a little harder. But even if you're not, there's still plenty to like here about See How They Run.
Awesome. That sounds great. I can't wait to watch it. And let's go to your other film for the week, Al.
Okay, so it's this movie called Due Revenge. And I didn't really know what kind of movie it was. Like, I had a vague idea. It's like, oh, yeah, it's a comedy about, two high school girls who try to get revenge on those who have wronged them. It's like, okay, great. I love a movie set in a high school. Like, comedy? Sure. I was not prepared for what kind of movie this was going to be. It is very much inspired by Strangers on a Train. It's to the point where we actually, like, they're not subtle about it. Like, there's actually a moment where you see one of the main characters reading Patricia Highsmith's Strangers on a Train. Like, they're not going for subtlety here, which is good. Like, it's not that kind of movie. But it's also very evocative of the sort of darker side of high school comedies that we've seen at various times over the years. Shades of like Heathers or Cruel Intentions, maybe a little bit of Mean Girls, a little bit of Election, like these sorts of movies. kind of jammed together. And it's always a little concerning when you have a movie that is so transparent about its influences. Like, you worry that it's going to come off as derivative.
Right.
But the people involved in this film have done a really wonderful job of sort of making something that is, you know, celebratory of its influences, but not defined by them, which is not easy to do. And so you get something that's really a lot of fun. Okay, so we have a young lady named Drea, played by Camila Mendes. She's risen to the top of the food chain at her Tony prep school. She's dating the big man on campus. This charming dude named Max, played by Austin Abrams. Like, she's a top tier student on the fast track to getting into Yale, which is her primary goal. All of her friends are rich kids, and she's there on scholarship. But, you know, that's not a barrier for them. Like, there's a level of acceptance. Until there isn't. So what happens is Max charms Drea into recording a video. We'll just say it's a video. An intimate video. And she agrees. She loves him. He loves her. But then the next day, wouldn't you know it, everyone in school has seen this video. Mm. He claims that he got hacked. She doesn't believe him. There's a confrontation. And then it's the end of the year, so everyone kind of goes their separate ways for the summer. Drea goes off to a tennis camp, where she basically seethes the whole summer. She's an instructor. And she's just angry about how this all went down. Over the course of that summer, she meets Eleanor, played by Maya Hawke, who's an awkward, weird girl who's at tennis camp and, clearly wants to be friends, but it's kind of slow going at first. But slowly and surely, the two sort of make a connection. And it turns out Eleanor is going to transferring to Drea's high school for her senior year. So they're going to be in school together. She gets back and everybody's turned on her. Like, her former best friend is now dating Max. Max is using the whole thing to do a bunch of performative allyship sorts of things. And, and basically uses Drea as a prop to sort of enhance his own stature. She's furious. She can't handle it. And then there's a moment where Drea and Eleanor decide, well, perhaps we can help one another. Because you see, Eleanor, the reason she is transferring and she is struggling so much is because of an incident at camp years ago, wherein she was sort of made into a social pariah through circumstances that I will not detail. But if you see the movie, you will see for yourself. And wouldn't you know it, Eleanor's former tormentor also goes to this school. And so Drea and Eleanor trade adversaries and they're going to use one another to get their revenge. Do hijinks ensue, Rich? Oh, you better believe it.
Of course they do.
Man, let me tell you, these girls are not screwing around and they go real hard, in ways that, might surprise you.
Hmm.
In a good way. Very funny, but very dark. Like, it's one of those things where it's like, oh, so we're like, we're full on, like, we're destroying people's lives here. Okay. Like, I guess that's how we're going to do these things. And we watch as each of them is sort of changed by the experience, some positive changes, some negative changes. And we have to see if, is their friendship, is their friendship more than just this revenge plot? Is there anything beyond what happens if they get what they want, or is this all there is? And we kind of get a little bit of that, the complexities of teenage friendship, particularly teenage girl friendship, play out against this backdrop of, again, at times, really devious and borderline sociopathic revenge. It's really funny. Really well made. It's got this it's so hard to make a movie that is both very much of its time but also feels kind of like a throwback. Mm. And this movie has that sort of dark teen movie vibe that I don't think you really get as much anymore. It's either like, it either goes out, you're either getting outright horror, or it's like, you know, kind of bland, like tee-hee kind of comedy. And you don't get that sort of edgy stuff quite the same way that you used to. The fact that this is coming from Netflix kind of blows my mind a little bit, because you know, they're definitely not known for you know, they like to stay in the mushy middle as a rule. And this one, again, I mean, you know, when your two stars are like one of the main characters on Riverdale and, you know, Ethan Hawke and Uma Thurman's kid, like obviously, like you're operating in a sort of middle ground. But as far as like, I guess the best thing I could say about it is, I figured this would be an okay kind of movie to have on, like you just half pay attention to, and I genuinely enjoyed it. Like, it is the sort of movie where if you have any affinity for those sort of, you know, edgier teen comedies of the 80s, 90s, and early aughts, or if you just want to see a Gen Z riff on Hitchcock, like, there's that too. So it's just like, it's all these wonderful pieces that probably shouldn't fit together, and yet kind of do. So I cannot believe I'm saying this, but yeah, you should probably do Revenge.
Nice. Well, I'm looking forward to both of them after those reviews.
Yeah, that's a couple of solid ones this week.
Excellent. Thanks, Al.
Hey, my pleasure.
Have a great week. We'll see you next time.
Yes, sir.
Alan Adams of The Main Edge with us